1 John chapter 3, verses 4 through 8. Everyone who sins breaks the law. In fact, sin is lawlessness. But you know that he appeared so that he might take away our sins, and in him is no sin. No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. No one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. Dear children, do not let anyone lead you astray. He who does what is righteous, just as he is righteous. He who does what is sinful is of the devil. Because the devil has been sinning from the beginning, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work.
Well, good to see everyone is with us this morning. And if you're visiting with us, and I think we have several, we're really glad you're here. We still, in this, of course, Labor Day weekend, this is kind of rounding out the summer for a lot of people in this country, and indeed we have a lot of our people who are away. But, again, we've got a number of folks here today, and that's because we do have several visitors and so forth. So we're glad you're with us, and we appreciate you coming out and being with us this morning. I got a few announcements I need to make before I actually get into the lesson. In fact, several of them, so just bear with me. One, if you look on the bulletin board out in the foyer, I put up, as I've been doing for the last couple of months, I put up a new upcoming events, and please check those out, or you can go to the website at www.eococ.com, and I posted events for both September and October on there, so if you want to check that out. And you can always consult that or look on the bulletin board, and of course we'll announce them as they're imminent. But do look at that and join us in those activities, and I'm sure you'll find them helpful. Also, if you look on the bulletin board, you can find some more information. You remember we announced last Sunday about the packets or packages that we're going to be sending to the young people who are away for college. Now, let me just read Juliet's note here. The names of the young people that we will be sending encouragement packets to is on the bulletin board. So you can consult that for their names, and that's in the back. Is it foyer? In the foyer. And you can start, of course, writing your letters of encouragement. They would appreciate you doing that, so jot your notes down and so forth. And also, you can contribute to them. They're going to be purchasing gift cards to send along, and if you know young people in college, they can always use that. So if you'd like to join in on that, look at the list of names and see Juliet or Jacqueline Georgie or Sandra Mahoney, and you know, contribute to that. It's a good thing, of course. And we've got a number of young people that are away, and they will certainly be encouraged, I'm sure, by this. So good effort, and please join in with that. Also, on a sadder note, because I really hate this, the summer's flown by, and we've been privileged to have Pam Blemman back with us, and I've enjoyed that. I know you've enjoyed that. She's written a note. She's going to be leaving us in a couple of days, and so I'm going to read this note to you, and as I said, we're sad to see her go. She says, "Dear brethren, thanks for the outpouring of love I was given by all of you. Everyone made me feel so very special, and I was never happier. Also, a special thanks to all those who gave so generously toward purchasing the Bibles and the correspondence courses for the church in Owea on the island of St. Vincent. May the Lord continue His blessings upon each and every one of you. I'll be leaving on Wednesday the 5th, and of course a couple of days, and hope to be on the island that same day. Hope to come again if the Lord wills it. Love, Pam Blemman." And we certainly hate to see her go. If you want to, you can actually twist her arm a little bit and see if she won't come back and stay permanently. But anyway, we're glad to have had her for the summer. A couple of other announcements on a little better note, and then we'll get into our lesson. First of all, we want to welcome Julie Jenkins and her family. Julie is placing membership here, and I think she and at least Tyra and or Jaleesa are here. But welcome them. They've been with us, of course, for several months now, and we're glad they're here. They're officially joining with us, and that's great. I'm really glad to hear that. So make sure you welcome them. And also, I'll join with Bill. We had a tremendous occasion Thursday night, and Joe Joseph, as I call him, Joe was baptized into the Lord, and he's here this morning with his daughter, Michaela. So please make sure you welcome them and give him all the encouragement you can. Without any further delay, let's answer this question, or at least talk about it. Why does God let certain things happen in life? Why does God let it happen? And that's going to be the question that we approach this morning. Why does God allow bad things to happen? You know, one of the most difficult concepts, I think, for people, both believers and non-believers, is if there is a God such as we see in the Bible, a good God, as He's portrayed to be, a loving God, as He's portrayed to be, then why does a good and loving God allow bad things? You notice I put that in quotation marks, because that's the way we see them. Bad things to happen in this world. For example, all of the sickness. Early this month, I came to services one Sunday morning, beautiful day. Everything was going great. My dad had had surgery a couple of days before. Everything was going fine. He was recovering fine. I get in from church and get a call from my brother. He's had a heart attack. He's not, you know, good chance he's not going to make it. You better get down here quickly. And so I jump in the car and I head down to Alabama. Why do things like that happen? Or all of the hunger. You know, in this country, this is Labor Day, and everybody's going to be barbecuing or eating at someone. We started it earlier and had a barbecue yesterday next door, and so we have all of this abundance of food, and you eat until you shouldn't have eaten that much, and you're about to pop and so forth, and that's the nature of our country. It's a blessed land. There's abundance, but not everybody in the world enjoys that. In fact, it is said that as much at any given time as 80% of the world is hungry. That's hard for us to imagine. And even if they eat on a quote-unquote regular basis, they remain hungry. I know when I visited Haiti a number of years ago, I was just amazed at all of the hunger. I was amazed at all of the effort that has to go into just being able to eat, and something that we just take for granted. You know, our biggest questions we have about our food is, you know, are we going to cook today or eat out at some restaurant? What are we going to have? And we get bored. We have so much, we just get bored with it. We don't even think in terms of a bowl of rice every day, or a bowl of rice is all we will have every single day for maybe our entire life. I mean, it's just an amazing concept. All of the death. Why do people have to die? Why are good people taken away from us? Someone that we love so much, someone we enjoy spending time with, why do we have to lose them? And why did God create such a world if there is a God? Why did He create such a world in which there is death and it hurts so much? Or all of the sin. I mean, this is no Garden of Eden. And the world is filled with sin. And sin hurts. And it has hurtful consequences to people. Children suffer so much. Why is all of that? And we might even go to this point and say, why are there all the violent crimes? Why does God allow that? In fact, lately, we've just seen a rash of shootings. I prepared this lesson, or started preparing this lesson. You may remember a few weeks ago, it almost seems like months and months ago now. But in fact, it was only July the 20th when a gunman opened fire in a theater in Aurora, Colorado, and at a Batman movie, of all things, and just started indiscriminately killing people. And as you can see, one of the headlines that I just copied here, gunman kills 12 in Aurora shooting at Batman movie. And so I thought it would be a good time following that shooting to have a lesson and ask this question, why does God let things like that happen? Little did I know before the lesson would make it here that on August 5th, while I was gone, a shooter would open fire at a temple in Wisconsin and kill 6 Sikhs there. An extremist, a white, I think, supremacist or whatever he was. But anyway, killing people there just for going to this particular temple in a land where there is religious freedom. And little did I know that when I came back, there would be yet another shooting over here at the Empire State Building where 9 would be wounded, yes, in fire from police and so forth, but the idea that someone would just open fire in New York City, I always think about how difficult it would be to get into New York City with all that you have to pass through, but I suppose someone can just walk around with a gun and open fire. 9 wounded, 1 dead in a shooting at the Empire State Building, and that had not even sunk in before 3 days later, on the first day back to school in Baltimore, there was a shooting in the Baltimore area at that school on their first day back. Now, all of that's happened in the space of a month. And yet, when you look at all of that, you realize that, you know what? We've seen that. It doesn't even surprise you anymore. I remember, and a lot of you can, think back some 20-plus years, especially to the Oklahoma, the bombing there, and the Columbine shooting. Do you remember how surprised, perhaps, you were when you started hearing of things like that? But it was a surprising event. I can remember those two events dominated the television, and not for a few hours' time, but weeks, because it was just so outrageous. It was something you could not believe that, for example, a couple of kids could walk into a high school and just start walking around through the halls, opening fire and killing students. You couldn't believe it. Now, you're not even surprised at it. Because we've seen that so much over the last 20 to 25 years at such an alarming rate that it just doesn't surprise you. And even after I got this sermon prepared earlier this week, there was yet another one. And so Friday I'm driving the car, and I hear now an ex-Marine has killed 2 co-workers in Old Bridge right here in New Jersey. We hear it all the time, don't we? Someone's mad. Someone's upset. Someone doesn't like this. He doesn't like that. Someone's had a bad childhood, a bad life, whatever it might be. So what does he do? He takes a gun. He kills people, and usually, or perhaps, he kills himself. Why does God let that happen? It's a question we want to at least look at. And I think we have to start with the question, how do we view God? Because what happens is people immediately start looking for an answer to this. Why does it happen? Why is it allowed to happen? Why does God let it happen? And eventually, and really very shortly, your attention turns to your whole view of God. How do you see God? Who is God? And how does God think, why does God think the way He does? Why does He allow things like this happen? I want to suggest to you that many people, and I said this, if you remember, in a sermon about 6 weeks ago, but many people have a false concept of God. It is not the biblical view of God. God takes many forms, and there are many ideas about God, and one of the most popular views of God in this world is that God is a glorified, what I'll call, fix-it man. It is not that most people in this world, especially in this country, and that's what I'm really focusing on, it's not that most people in this country really look at God as the God of the Bible, the God who created us, the God whose subjects we are, the God whom we will live our lives either according to what He says and what He wills, or we won't, and we will one day stand in judgment before. But it is rather, God is someone to fix my problems. Other than that, I don't need God. I don't want to be bothered with God. I don't want to fool with God and all of the things that go with God. But when I'm in trouble, I want God. And it's almost as though God is like a medicine. When you're sick, you go to the medicine cabinet, you open it up, you pull out the pill, you pop it, you feel better. That's the view of God. God is a glorified fix-it man. When I have a problem, I call on God. So therefore, it's not surprising that when there are bad things that happen, people immediately start thinking of, where is my medicine? Where's my fix? Where is God? I want to suggest to you that the Bible teaches us that God can repair broken lives. God can forgive devastating sins. Things that your conscience kills you over, God can fix that. God can restore. And I want you to hear this, because I believe the Bible teaches it. God can restore innocence. When the Bible speaks of God forgiving sins, God takes them away. They are removed. The Bible is very poetic and very graphic about how much God removes sin so that you are innocent in God's sight. God can give us eternal hope. Now notice I say eternal, because it's not necessarily hope for this world, at least not in every way that people want hope. If you expect to have a Garden of Eden on earth, that's a false expectation, and God is not promising that. But God will not, against His nature and against His plan, fix, quote unquote, every problem in our lives so that we never have to suffer in this life. I remember sitting in the audience way back, and I come from a Pentecostal background, and you have to understand that there are some beliefs among some of those people, not all of them, but among some of those people that once you become a Christian, or once you're saved, is usually the way we said it, once you are saved and once you are certainly sanctified, you just never sin again. And that God promises you, if you live that sinless life, that God promises you that you're not going to have any problems. And so all sickness can be taken away. All trouble, all sorrow, all heartache, all bad things in life can be removed. And that's just not so. Some of them would even go to the extreme to say, if you have enough faith, you don't even have to die. For even if you did, God could raise you back from the dead. And God does not teach that. Now, do I believe that God has the power to remove every problem? Of course. The same power that can take a little boy's lunch and just keep dividing it is the way I always picture it. A couple of little fish and some bread and just divide and divide and divide and divide and divide and feed thousands of people has the power to do anything. But He does not choose to. He fed the thousands, the 5,000, the 4,000, etc. But He did not feed every human in the world. He raised dead people, but not every dead person. He healed sick people, but not every sick person. And the question has to be, why? Why did He do that? Why did He choose to do that? It must relate to His plan. It must relate to His will. And I have to accept the fact that yes, He is a powerful God with the ability to remove every problem I have, but He won't. You're reminded together with me of the Apostle Paul, for example, who had a thorn in the flesh. Was that bad eyesight? Well, he certainly had bad eyesight. But whether that's what he's talking about, or persecution, or whatever it might be, whatever the problem was, he asked three distinct times for it to be removed, and God said no. It was not part of God's plan. It was not part of God's will. It wasn't God's plan or His will for the world at large. And it wasn't His plan and His will for Paul in particular. It would have been, whether it's, you know, I can grasp this in my head or not, Paul makes the point in that passage, lest I be exalted above measure, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh. Now, Paul saw it as a bad thing, and he wanted it removed. And God said, no, my strength is sufficient for you. And the point of that is, God knows better than I know. God knows better than even the Apostle Paul knew. And so we go to God and we ask for things to be removed. We ask for things to stop. And sometimes God says, no, can't do that. That's not what's best. It's not what you need. We have to understand that. Our view of God has got to go beyond just a fix-it man. And we have to understand, or at least to the degree we can, we have to understand the very nature of this world and of this life. Now let me go a little bit further with that. Let's talk about the nature of this world. Because this question begs a straightforward answer. Somebody looks at me and says, why does God let Osama bin Laden order some planes into the World Trade Center and thousands of people die? Well, there's an answer to that. It may not be the answer we all want to hear, but There is an answer why God lets it happen. God doesn't do it necessarily. But God lets things like that happen. Why? You know, given, I mean, just think, let's just think more recent. The tragedies of the recent days, all these shootings. I think it does us good to remind ourselves why it is happening and why it's allowed to happen. First of all, think of the passage that Kevin read a moment ago, 1 John chapter 3. Evil is always the result of sin. I think all of us would admit when someone takes a gun and starts shooting innocent people, that is sin. When someone drives a plane or whatever, into pilots a plane, I guess you would correctly say, into a World Trade Center, that is sin. And sin is the choice, and I want you to focus on that. It is the choice to break the law of God. We can look at all those incidents. We can look at the recent killings, let's say the Batman movie. The guy had a choice. He chooses to walk into the theater. And he chooses to break the law of God. The law of God would say, thou shalt not kill. It's very explicit. You don't murder people. It is against the law of God. And you suffer consequences from God when you sin. But that individual, and I don't recall his name, but he chose to break the law of God. Now, a person might say, well, why does God let that happen? Because God must let it happen. You say, that's ridiculous. No, listen to it. God must allow man the freedom to choose to do evil. There are countless people around the world who are looking up at God and are saying to God, why do you let this happen? I've been one of those people many times, starting when I was a child and certain things that happened in my childhood. And I prayed when I was a child. I was brought up that way. And I would pray and I would lay in my bed, usually at night, and I would lay there for a long time and I would ask God, why are you letting this happen? It hurts so much. I don't want this to happen. I don't want to go through this. And I would beg for God to take it away, but He didn't take it away. Why? Because God must allow man the freedom to choose to do the evil, or else man has no free will. If God looked down here and every time someone chose to sin, and that sin was going to have the consequence of hurting innocent people, if God stopped it, where would be the freedom? Where would be the freedom of choice, the freedom of will? On what basis would God ever judge us? On what basis would there ever be a difference, a decision? Now you might say, well, I'd rather you do that. Really? Would you? What God would have in that case would be mindless robots or whatever. But it would not be individuals with real choice. And there's no reward if there's no choice. I mean, think about it like this. If you do something spectacular because you chose to do it, and because you chose to put forth the effort, because you expended the energy and you made sacrifices and so forth, when you accomplish what you accomplish, you feel good about it. You enjoy it. It means something. But if something happens where you had no choice, you did nothing, it just happened. You might like it, but it doesn't mean very much. It didn't cost you anything, so it doesn't mean anything. That's true in every part of life. And that is certainly true in the most important part of life, the idea of going to heaven or not. People in heaven are either going to have been children, babies, you know, that died in infancy or whatever. Or they are going to be people who made choices and sacrifices and who by the freedom of their will chose to obey God. And it is going to mean something. You are going to be in heaven knowing that you belong there. You know, it's hard down here to grasp that. You look at yourself, you see everything you've done, and you say, man, I don't belong in heaven. Who does? Who of any of us that are grown, that have made wrong choices, deserve to be in heaven? I mean, that's the way we see it. But the truth is, you do. The truth is, if you choose to obey God, You choose to do what's right. You pay the price. You choose to be there, and you deserve it. And you will know that and feel that all through eternity. Now, if God doesn't allow freedom of will, if there is no choice, if there's never that choice to do good or bad, that choice to do sin or not, that choice not to affect the consequences on other people, there's no price to be paid, and there's no real heaven. God has designed the world with freedom to choose, so He must allow it. To acknowledge something is evil, you see, is to admit the breaking of a higher law. I mean, by the very fact that we call it evil, we look at a bad thing. However you want to say it, it's bad, it's evil, it's sinful. You're acknowledging there's a higher law, a greater good, that demands of us as human beings to do differently. And if such a law never existed, there would be no such thing as evil. Let's go to the book of Romans, and I'm going to read a couple of passages out of Romans in the latter part of this sermon. But let's start in Romans chapter 4, and notice something Paul said down in verse 15. Now, a lot of this, and with respect to my class this morning, I'm going to not take out of context, but I'm not going to read the verses around it. But you can go home and do that. And you'll notice as Paul is discussing this in Romans 4 and verse 15, and he's talking in a context of choosing to do good things, good works, instead of bad. But look at verse 15. Because the law works or produces wrath. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, God has a law. He had an Old Testament law. He has a New Testament law. God has law. And law is what incurs wrath. Why? Because by the very fact that there is a law, when you break it, and you do evil, and you indiscriminately do that, and there's no repentance of it, is the point. Like some of these shootings and so forth, when you do that, you incur the wrath of God. For where no law is, there's no transgression. You see, what's happening is our minds, our thinking is being pushed towards something. And that's what I want you to kind of hold on to. By the very fact that you recognize things as evil, you recognize things are wrong. They're bad. They should not happen. By the very fact that you can recognize that, it is pointing to the fact that there is a law. And there is someone who gave that law. If such a law never existed, there would be no such thing as evil. And your mind, your thinking, would not be directed so to realize that. Let's make another point. Evil drives one. Turn over a few pages to Romans 7. Evil, bad things drive you. Whether it's bad things like turning on the TV and seeing some guy killed a bunch of people in Wisconsin or Colorado or New Jersey. Or whether it is the bad things, the evil you do or I do in my life. It drives you to dependency on God. Now, why is that? I know that I have freedom to choose. You know it too. Every one of you sitting there, myself standing here, I can think about my own life, all the choices that I make in a given week that no one knows about but me. And so do you. You know that as well. And you know you have freedom to choose. You know that if you choose to do so, you can go out today and you can sin. You could even decide to do one of these terrible, hideous things that some of these people have chosen to do in the last 6 weeks. You have a freedom of will. But you also know that things are wrong. And as long as you understand that, really whether you've committed them or not, as long as you understand it, it is directing your attention to a law and to the one who gave it. Now listen to Paul as he talks about in Romans 7. And let's start in verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? In other words, is it that the law of God is bad? Some people are starting to think like that. If there's a great, you know, if there's a whole lot of breaking of it, well then just do away with the law. Well, that's not the answer. It doesn't help anything. Is the law sin? No, may that never be so. No, I had not known sin. Notice how your thinking is being directed here. I had not known sin but by the law. For I had not known lust, except the law said, thou shalt not covet. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, thou shalt not covet, worked in me all manner of evil concupiscence. The idea of lust, strong, intense desire for what's wrong. For without the law, sin was dead. I think he speaks of when he was a child. I once was alive without the law. But when the commandment came, that is when I grew up, and I understood things are bad or they are good. Things are right or they are wrong. Things are evil or they are good. He said, when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. I died because I chose to sin. The commandment which was ordained to life I found to be unto death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it, it killed me. Now, have you ever felt that? I know I have. And I know when you've sinned and you come to the full realization that I chose to do that. Well, you can blame your circumstances of life. You can talk about, well, this person didn't do what they were supposed to do, and that person didn't do what they were supposed to do, and life has just stunk anyway, and so that's why I went out and did all these things. I can do that. I have done that. But at some point, I have to be honest enough with myself to say, you know what, Michael? You still chose. And you knew when you were doing it. You knew before you did it. You knew while you were doing it, and you knew after you did it, you were choosing to do the wrong. That's what Paul is saying here. I died. And I know what it feels like to do certain things in this life. Maybe not every sin we commit we feel this way, but I know that for most of us, if not all of us, there are those certain things, we do them, and it just kills us. And you can't, as people say, I can't live with it. I can't live with myself. And that's where Paul was as he talked about this. Now notice, as I talk about here on the chart, I say it drives us to recognize that God is right. The righteousness of God and the despondency of sin without it. Listen to Paul as he goes on here in verse 13. Was then that which is good made death unto me? In other words, is it God's fault? And is it the law of God? Is that what is bad? Well, no. But sin, that it might, notice this phrase, that it might appear sin. You see how God uses your own life experiences, your own bad choices, to make you realize how bad sin really is? I can tell a kid downstairs in a class all day long that sin is a horrible thing. He will never understand that until he does the sin. And when his conscience kills him, when he hates himself for what he has done, then he will understand how bad sin is. When he sees the consequences and the people around him who love him, then he will understand how horrible sin is. Sin that it might appear sin, working death in me, by that which is good, that sin by the commandment might become exceeding sinful. And then this tongue twister of a passage. But listen to what Paul is saying. For we know that the law is spiritual. But I'm carnal. I'm sold in bondage to sin. And that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that do I not. But what I hate, that's what I do. And if then I do that which I wouldn't do, I consent to the law that it is good. If it's me by my freedom of choice, making a choice to do what I hate, then what do I realize? God had it right all along. God's way is the better way. Now then it's no more I that does it, but sin that dwells in me. In other words, what he's saying here, and this is what I really believe Paul is saying, the worst things I've ever done in my life. I might hate myself. I might condemn myself. But you know what I have to realize is that's not totally me. There's another part of me. There's a good part of me. There's a part of me that hates me for doing what I do. And while that may sound very strange, I believe many people, if not most, can identify with it. There's a better part of you that would rather you just didn't do all that. Put yourself through all of that. And I think that's what he's saying. I know, verse 18, that in me, That is in my flesh dwells no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. Have you ever found how to live a perfect life? Well, if you have, I'd like to know, you know. I've never found it either. I try. And I hate it when I don't. But you see, that's driving me to realize, and please hear this, it's driving me to realize I can't make it on my own. None of us can. Paul says, verse 19, the good that I would do, I don't. The evil that I wouldn't do, that's what I do. And if I do that I wouldn't do, it's no more I that do it, but sin that dwells in me. I find in a law a principle that when I would do good, evil is present with me. You ever found that for yourself? The harder you try to do what's good, the more opportunity, the more temptation, the more it seems like that Satan or something is always there for you to fail. That's the way it works. I delight in the law of God after the inward man. Do you know what that feels like? You ever had a day or a time in your life when you really were doing everything you could possibly do? Not that you'd be arrogant enough to say, I'm perfect, but you've done your best and you know it. And you feel really good about that. I mean, it's just a good feeling. Well, if you've had that, you know exactly what he's saying here. I delight in the law of God. But I see another law, verse 23, warring in my members against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity or even slavery here to the law of sin which is in my members. And so he comes to this point, verse 24, O wretched man that I am. And when you get to that point of feeling like a wretch, of feeling like you and what you've done is the most horrible thing on earth, that's when God is saying, that's it! That's it! That's where I wanted you to be. That's what I want you to understand. You can't make it without me. That's what God is saying. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? And Paul knows. How do you get deliverance from that? How do you live with yourself after you've done that big thing in life that you think no one else would forgive you for? That you think no one else has ever done, because that's the way it feels. No one's ever been as bad as you. You know, Paul lived with that. How would you like to be an apostle and everywhere you went, you were responsible for killing the first martyr of Jesus Christ? How would you like to be known for that for all eternity? He said that to Jesus. I'm not worthy. You can't send me. I was there. I did it. Jesus said, you're exactly who I want. Because you can go out there and you can tell them what it feels like. You can go out there and you can show them an example of what it means to be cleansed and be innocent again. And most everybody you meet, no matter what they've done, will look at themselves and say, well, I guess at least I didn't do that. You're exactly because you recognize that it is only through Jesus Christ that you have deliverance. You can't deliver yourself. That's what it drives us to. Why does God let it happen? Because it shows us our complete dependency on Him. I can walk through this life. I can be arrogant. I can feel invincible. I can feel like nothing will happen to me. I can feel like whatever I do or whatever I choose to do, I can do it and get away with it. I know that kind of pride and that kind of arrogance. And I know what it means to be brought down from that and to realize you can't make it without God. That's what God is saying. That's why I let it happen. How do we view God? Well, let's wrap it up. What do we say? There is evil in this world. And Satan and man, ourselves, we're responsible for it. We choose it. And that's what the Bible teaches us. You know, I won't read these passages, but such as James chapter 1. Let no man say when he's tempted of God. Every man is tempted, and I know this for myself, and so do you. I'm tempted when I'm drawn away of my own lust and enticed. And I choose to do the sin, and I bear the grief for the sin I choose to do. There is evil in this world. We choose it. Some argue a good God would never allow the evil, so there must not be a good God. But you know, reverse that and ask. Why isn't the world just filled with evil? I mean, we're selfish people. We all want what we want. We all have the tendency just to grab it when we want it. So why isn't the world filled with evil? Why is there good in the world? Why is there so much good in the world? Why every disaster do people come out of the woodwork to help other people? What's driving people to do that? Where did all of the good come from? You know, I can get so consumed with all the bad that I can't see the good. But there's good everywhere. You look around you and you might look at the people even in this room. You might look at me and you might see all the bad. But if you stop to think, there's some good. There's good everywhere if you just look for it. Quite obviously, I think we're forced to admit that the existence of one, good or evil, doesn't preclude or take away the other. It's not that there is no good God because there's evil in the world. And likewise, it's not that there's no good because there's evil in the world. Whoop, too far there. In God's great plan, by His will, bad things are allowed to happen. Because they affect a greater good. Even if that good is driving us to God, it's a greater good. God does things or allows things to happen to accomplish His will or perpetuate His plan for His creation. And whether we perceive it or not, everything has to be according to the Lord's will. You know, truthfully, I can only see with tunnel vision. I only see my world and a lot of times only myself. And it's hard not to. And no matter how much I'm willing to look beyond it, I'll never be able to see what God can see. Since the fall of man, as Romans teaches us here, the world groans. Read the passage in Romans 8. I'm not going to take the time to read it, but you read it today. Look at Romans 8 in verses 17 through 24 and how it talks about the fact that since man began to choose to sin, the whole world suffers. And the world groans for a time. It aches, we sometimes say, for a time when there will be no more tears and no more sorrow and no more death, no more pain, no more sickness. And that time will come. It will come when Jesus comes back and the world ends. God will restore a perfect fellowship with Him. In heaven, none of those things will exist ever. And that's why evil can't be removed from us now. Because we haven't gotten to the end yet. It's just like anything that's worth having, you got to pay a price now to have it. And we haven't gotten there yet. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, what does this lesson say? There's evil in the world. An honest admission of that. There's evil in me. Honest admission of that. But God is the answer. And I'm driven to see that. There can't be a good life for me. There can't be a better life here. And there can't be a perfectly good life for me anytime unless this is allowed to happen here. But someday, by the help and grace of God, life can be better. And God can take some things away. Some of the things that I do, I can get stronger and I can overcome. But regardless, someday I can be in perfect harmony and fellowship with God in a perfect place. If you want to go to that place and you believe Jesus is the Son of God and you'll confess that, be willing to change your life and live your life for the Lord. You'll be baptized just like the Apostle Paul. All your sins, no matter what they are, will be washed away. And you'll be His child. And you know, you might be here and you might have done that and still your life might not be right. And a lot of times we have to come back. Kind of come back to point one and have things forgiven, confess those things to God, change those things, and start all over. A lot of good people have had to do that. Won't you please come while we stand and sing?